Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namā Sāmi. Sometimes giving so many talks in many different places, but trying to save the best talks for the community of monks and nuns, people have really committed themselves to the practice. I just remember when I was in Thailand, just about all the talks, 90% of the talks, or 90% of the content of the talks which you had heard, were all about the Vinaya or the core what, just the rules of discipline in a monastery. And we were just reminded earlier about our core what practice, which Venerable Rinpoche said is very, very dusty in the library. No, I don't know if it's in the library or in the office somewhere. Haven't picked it up for a long time. But, you know, sometimes I'm quite proud of that, because basically those core what's there only when you really need it. And because the monks in this monastery are behaving well, and most of you know roughly what the core what is, that's good enough. And, of course, the first rule of that core what is not that the abbot's always right. That's a joke core what. The first rule of the core what, which is the monastic rules, is like, be kind, be compassionate. And there's a reason for that. Because as you do in your daily life outside of your meditation seat, that's exactly, it influences what you do when you're sitting. And just the way which you wash the dishes is very much reflected in the way you meditate. The way that you run a monastery becomes the way in which monks run their mind, as it were. And the more that as a teacher, as an abbot, I can teach people how to let go with kindness and keep things loose, you'll find that then when you meditate, you can act with kindness and let things go and don't control so much, which means you get very peaceful mind states. I've been down, been a monk for such a long time and done so many meditation techniques and routines, you know, from Anapanasati, the Samatha method of the Samatha Society in UK where I first grew up, and with different forest teachers, Vipassana, under Mahasi Sayadaw's technique when it first came to UK about 40 years ago, doing all that sort of stuff. But realizing there's something underneath all of that, something fundamental with the path to liberation. And you can see that in the best monasteries which I've been to, where you have these teachers, the best ones, who are just so kind and so gentle. And sometimes you wonder about, you know, are they just slack teachers? But they became the real famous ones. And they're not slack teachers, they're incredibly wise and compassionate, who run monasteries through inspiration rather than just through through force. And that's how you meditate too. You meditate through inspiration, through compassion, through lifting the mind up, not out of negativity or out of fear, out of something much higher, more beautiful than that. The inspiration, you know, in the promise of freedom. The inspiration in just liberation. The inspiration which you get from just listening to a discourse like the fire sermon which we just chanted. This beautiful teaching of the six sense bases. And to see each one of them is on fire. Fire with greed, hate and delusion. And after a while you can get feeling for that, know what it is. And all these senses, the world in which you know is just burning. And just you get fed up with it after a while. No, properly fed up with it. Not just the outside, but the inside as well. As I often say, it's so easy, well it's hard, but it's much easier to let go of the outside world than let go of the inside world. Which is why people can actually sit in their huts. But they never get into jhanas or enlightenment. They can let go of the things outside, but they can't let go of the things inside, which stops them getting into this peaceful state. But the general idea of just not controlling and letting things be, being kind, being compassionate, not meditating to get things, but meditating to allow things to disappear. This is a path of Buddhism. And it's the outside reflects the inside reflects the outside. Which is why the old adage of the forest monasteries, you can tell a person's meditation by how they sweep. Because the sweeping was the main chore which the monks did in the forest monasteries of old. And so the teacher never used to have interviews. Because no one interview, you can present one face of your meditation, one aspect to the teacher. And you haven't got time to tell everything. You only give like a small window into what's happening in your meditation practice. But you can get much more information as a teacher if you just look at how people like wash their dishes or how people wash their bowls if they're monks, how people do the sweeping, how they just react to the things in life. Because there you see the same attitudes which give peace and tranquility in the external world. They will also be incredibly helpful to what you do when you meditate, when you sit down cross-legged. Which is why that, you know, just a monastery of like kindness, of simplicity, of making things not complicated. And I really try my hardest as like a leader, as an abbot, trying to uncomplicate the monastery. But you know what it's like, the world always adds complications. And I said at the beginning of the retreat, I said this even in Nolamara, please, out of faith and compassion in the Sangha who are on retreat, please may no one die during the rains retreat, so we have to go to funerals. And already we've got our first death and a funeral on Monday. So some people are just so stubborn. But of course, you say that with irony because you can't stop these things. These things happen. So you just take them in your stride. And the teaching which I always keep in my mind, you know, as a leader who has to take a lot of these burdens with the help of the other senior monks and the Anagarikas who have to do all the driving to these funerals and stuff. The teaching which I always bear in mind was again from the great Ajahn Chah. And this is a powerful teaching for each one of us to understand, and not just to understand and take inside of us, but to expand, to extrapolate, and to employ in so many different areas of our life. And that was a great teaching of Ajahn Chah when the villagers were being too noisy and they were having their parties till 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had to get up at 3 o'clock. And there was no sleeping in those monasteries. You had to get up. And not getting enough sleep. And so we complained to the villagers, if you're having a party, can you at least stop at 12 or 1 or something? Give us a couple of hours sleep. And of course they refused, so we went to go and see Ajahn Chah, thinking he'd have more influence. If he says it, the villagers will stop. But Ajahn Chah told us, he gave this great teaching, monks, what's the problem? It's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. When you've got a teacher like that, you know, you just go back, just you can't argue with him. You know, he just knows so much more than you do. He sees things deeper. Because that was true. It wasn't the noise disturbing us. We were disturbing that noise. We were disturbing samsara, because that's what samsara is like. It's not the kitchen cleanup disturbs you. You disturb the kitchen cleanup. It's not the sort of the cold or the cough or the bad knee disturbs you. You disturb the knee. And I take that teaching on board. And I, you know, for years I've been applying that teaching. It's not having to go to Sydney or receiving all these calls or people, you know, getting depressed, calling you to actually to have on telephone counseling. Because, you know, I have to do more than most as a monk. But I always remember that. It's not these things disturb me, I disturb them. Now that's an attitude which is very, very powerful. Because that's how I live my life. At least I try to, I aspire for that. But that's also what I do when I meditate. It's not the defilements, I shouldn't have used that word. It's not the distractions, the sound, the aches, the cold, whatever else it is. Or the thoughts, They're not the problem. It's not the thoughts disturb me or the sloth and torpor disturb me. It's I disturb the sloth and torpor. I disturb the thoughts. I disturb the mind. And I understand that just so well now because I had enough experience of meditation to notice that slight attitude change. It makes a huge difference. I was meditating in the Saturday afternoon at Nolamara a few weeks ago when we were still teaching there. Oh no, sorry, it was a Friday evening. And I remember just the Friday evening, get all these people come from work to listen to the Dharma, and many of them are just exhausted. And so when you teach meditation, it's not that uncommon that someone falls asleep and starts snoring. So there in Dhammaloka Center in Nolamara, Friday afternoon, quarter of an hour into the meditation, this person, I don't know if it was a boy or a girl, started snoring away. And of course, the first reaction, when you're getting nice and peaceful, I think I was just coming back from Toronto that evening. So really tired, you really want a bit of a rest to give a nice talk. But as soon as that person started snoring, the first image came up and said, "Can somebody wake him up? So he's disturbing me." But then, you know, maybe because I was tired, my mindfulness wasn't strong to remember the instructions immediately. But then I remembered, hang on, it's not the noise disturbing you. Me, Ajahn Brahm, is disturbing that guy snoring. So he just let it be. I said, I'm not going to disturb that guy. I'm just going to leave it alone. And straight away, the mind got really nice and peaceful. It was just such a delightful meditation from there on in. That's just an example of something which I remember reasonably recently. You know, I was just going to Sydney just last week, plane delayed for 2.5 hours. And I was just happily sit down in a corner. I had to do some homework, reading a book. And people came and talked to me and we had a nice chat. I had a wonderful time. So I wasn't disturbing the delay. It wasn't the delay that disturbs me, but in life, too often, people allow life to disturb them. And the reason, obviously we try to get a sort of a nice peaceful lifestyle, a simple lifestyle, but in the end, life is out of control. I learned that. You really try hard as a monk to try and make it as simple as possible, as perfect as possible. Now one day, when we get enough donations in this monastery, I promise each one of you, once we have enough donations, I'll get your own personal butler. And Anagarikas, hand out to professional cleaners the monthly cleanup of the kitchen. And we'll hire a chauffeur so the Anagarikas never have to drive the monks to go and visit people at night time or pick me up from the airport. I get a limo to pick me up with a professional. You know, it still won't work. Even if you had your own personal hairdresser, a personal attendant who can take your calls and everything else and had all these servants looking after you. So you could just stay in your hut, and your hut was fully air-conditioned with climate control. And sort of Ajahn Brahmada was saying that they have this underground heating, under-floor heating, which is very nice and warm. What was that, Ajahn Brahmada or Mudito? I forget who, but someone was saying just how wonderful it was to sit down. I think it was Ven Mudito. I saw him last weekend. To sit down, and the heat was right where you need it, in your bottom when you're meditating. He said it was so wonderful. He didn't actually want to get up from his meditation, not because he was getting good samadhi, because he had a nice warm bottom and he liked that. Now that's sort of stuff. Yeah, we can make it nice, but that's missing the point. Because when you do make it nice outside, you still have to deal with a mind when you meditate, which has always got this stuff in it. No matter how much you make it nice outside, it still doesn't stop this fault-finding mind which causes restlessness. This active mind which tries to control and make it even more perfect. I was mentioning it even in Sydney, that if you actually compare sort of what we have now compared to 50 years ago, for lay people, everyone lives in mansions. They live like kings, like sultans. Any sort of emperor 100 years ago, if they were transported into modern people's houses and saw these plasma screen TVs where they can get 20 channels or something on Foxtel and so much music and sport on demand and have just incredibly warm places and have food they can just take out of the refrigerator and just put it in a microwave, hot, which the emperor's kitchens could never match. And we do live like emperors, and as monks, Bodhinyana Monastery, compared to, say, the Jetavana Monastery, this is just so comfortable. You don't have to sort of worry about the insects, because, you know, live in nice rooms, and it is got some heating and reasonably cool in the summertime, and the great food we have. We don't have to worry about wars and famines and stuff. So this is actually amazing what we have now. But that's not the point. The point is, no matter how you, what sort of situation you're in, whether you're in a sort of the most remote and frugal forest monastery, eating frogs on rice, or you're having this beautiful food we have now, still we can always criticize. Still we can try and become greedy and try and control things. Still we can get involved. Still it's never ever good enough, because samsara sucks. Samsara is suffering. No matter how good it is, it's never good enough. So the external is not the problem. It's always how we react to it. It's always our relationship to what we're experiencing, which is what Ajahn Chah meant. It's not the sound which disturbs you. It's what you put between you and the sound. It's not the sound's fault. It's not your fault. It's the relationship, what we put in between. And understanding that, it's not the kitchen. It's not the driving. It's not the telephone calls. It's not the traveling. It's not all the business I have to do. That is not the issue. It's always how you relate to these things, how you react to them, what you put in that space between you and this moment. When you understand that, you understand why the first core what rule, the rule of the monastery, is to be kind. Because when I put that into the rules and make that important, the gentleness, the kindness, the softness, it's not what you do but how you do it, then that's how I meditate. That whole attitude transfers into what I do when I sit down and meditate. You're not doing this to try and get somewhere. We're not building monasteries to get more people. We're not building monasteries to get the monastery, you know, in the magazines, the most beautiful monastery. This is in the Western Hemisphere, or the Southern Hemisphere, sorry. You're not doing this for fame, fortune. You're doing this to be liberated, to be free, to stop samsara, to get out, basically, of the round of rebirths. So understand what we're here for. You understand the kindness and compassion which you put into your daily life, which you put into your relation to your body. Don't force the body too much, and don't be too lax either. Remember that simile of Sona, the guy with the hairs on his feet, who, you know, for some amazing sort of karma from the past, was so well nurtured that he had hair growing on the soles of his feet. And the king saw that, and the Sona saw the Buddha and became a monk. And like many people who become monks and nuns, they're already diligent enough. I always say this, especially Westerners, the very fact that you've ordained as monks and nuns means you're already highly motivated, otherwise you wouldn't get this far. Okay, in Thailand maybe, people become monks for a simple life, an easy life, a free meal ticket. But Westerners don't do that for the most part. You're very highly motivated people. If you wanted an easy life, you just go and disrobe and just bludge on the pension or whatever, or get an easy job somewhere, and you wouldn't have as much stuff to worry about and do. But you're here because you're motivated. And I realized that a long time ago. And don't need to force Western monks and nuns, or anyone who's born in Australia. If you make it this far to getting brown robes on you, as a man or a woman, to do that much, it already tells me, wow, you really want to be this monastic. So once you realize that this is what they want to do, your job is just to give them free rein. Off you go. You're already motivated enough. In fact, what I really need to do is actually to hold people back a bit. Because sometimes people like Sona, highly motivated, just go walking. so much that his feet bled. He had very tender feet. And so when his feet started bleeding and people saw their walking meditation path, they said it was like a slaughter yard where they killed cows and sheep and chickens. Now, I've never seen that on your paths. I don't know how much you walk. But if you did, you say, that's going a bit too far. Obviously, you'd like to see you walking a lot, getting a few calluses, but not going too far. In other words, yeah, motivation, but also a bit of compassion as well and some wisdom. So it's good to be motivated, you know, because it's a job to be done. But please do it with kindness, with gentleness, with patience. My saying is patience is the fastest way. We just have to sit and bear with rather than trying to get rid of or go for something. Because the compassion, which I've often mentioned, is a very powerful way of letting go with the addition of joy. Because compassionate love, if you like, metta, is this beautiful, soft, warm, cuddly thing which brings people a lot of joy. When people fall in love, they're happy. You know, when their mother hugs their child, they're happy. Sort of when you really do a great sort of kind thing for somebody, everybody gets happy when you see it. If it truly is compassion, it always has a sense of joy with it. If it really is kindness, there has to be some mental pleasure called piti sukha associated with it somewhere, if it's real metta. So if we understand that when we have this loving kindness in our own meditation, we're motivated, but we're kind, we've got this beautiful gentleness to us. Yeah, sure, we walk, but not so far, fast or so much that we start to bleed or we start to get injured. Our body's in good health. Usually, people who have good meditation are in good health. So when people start to get sickly, and they say because they're meditating a lot, there's something wrong there. Usually good health comes from good meditation. And as you all know, Ajahn Chah, I'm remembering Ajahn Chah this evening, Ajahn Chah's great teaching, when people would ask Ajahn Chah, how long should you meditate for every day? Should we try and do like 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours? And Ajahn Chah said, you Westerners are crazy. He said, now if it really mattered how long you sat, if that was really important to become enlightened, all the chickens in the world would be enlightened by now, because they sit much longer than you do, you know, without moving. Because they sit on their eggs for hours, days sometimes without moving. But I must admit, I've never seen a chicken who's enlightened. So Ajahn Chah called that chicken meditation, when you just sit there just wondering about how many hours you sit. That's not the point. It's a quality of that time. Obviously, it's important to spend time meditating. That is important to put the hours in. That's what we're here for, to meditate. But it's also the quality of the time as well. And how do we make that quality time when we do have a time to sit? Actually, the two work together. When the meditation is high quality, you do tend to sit a long time because you just want to, you like to, you can't stop yourself, but you want to sit. And you have to sit, you have to stay there because you're having too good a time to get out. And this is actually when we put the quality into the meditation, this kindness, this gentleness, this letting go. We meditate not to get something, please remember that. If you're trying to attain jhanas in this meditation retreat, you're stuffing your brain up, you'll never get anywhere. We're not supposed to be getting jhanas. We're not even supposed to be getting enlightened. We're supposed to be still making the causes for jhanas, producing the ground in which enlightenment might happen. That's our job. It's like a simile of a person who wants to sort of have some friends coming into their house. And they grab the nearest stranger and pull them into their house, and that person leaves as soon as possible. It's not how to get visitors to come into your house. If you see jhana walking down the street, and you try and pull first jhana into their house, they'll just disappear as soon as you get them, even if you can catch hold of them. The way to get Mr. Jhana into your house, or Mrs. Insight into the house, is actually to have this beautiful house with a nice food on display, you know, some nice fish and chips. I'm sure first jhana loves, well, from an English first jhana, whatever it is, some noodles or something, if you want a sort of Chinese jhana. I don't know, but you know what I'm talking about. If you make your house attractive and there's some good food, of course people will come and visit. You don't need to drag them in, and they will stay a long time. Why? It's because you've made the preparations, you've got the causes in place. Why these things come in the first place? And look, Mr. and Mrs. Jhana will never come into your mind if you've got no compassion, if you're too hard and harsh. No way will they visit you. They'll take one look in there and say, I don't belong in such a mind. Mr. and Mrs. Jhana will never come in to visit you if you're not virtuous, if you're getting angry and speak terrible things at each other. Mr. and Mrs. Jhana will look at you and say, those are violent people. Look at the way they speak to each other. Look at the harshness, the cruelty. I'm not going to go and visit them. And so there's no way that Mr. and Mrs. Jhana or their sort of parents, you know, I suppose to say their four parents, three meaning once returning, non-returning, and arahat, because, you know, every couple, they've got two parents on one side and two parents on the other side, so they've got four parents in all. I'm making this up as I go along. So they won't be able to actually to come into your house at all, the four stages of enlightenment or the jhanas. So no way will they be able to come in if you haven't prepared the house properly. So you can see the simile here. Your job is to prepare your mind. So these things actually come in, they happen to you. And the preparation, you know, is kindness, gentleness, letting go, the three right intentions. Having a pure mind because you've done lots of good karma. This was, you know, my practice of meditation, just the insights which come up when you get into deep meditations. That's the juicy part where insights really happen. And I think you know the story of when you started getting nimittas coming up, and you got all these different types of nimittas coming up, and especially you get stable nimittas and very bright, but sometimes you would see stains in the nimittas or a little bit of dirt as if like the thing hadn't been washed or you spilt something on it. And it was fascinating just investigating those. What is that sort of little stain or that dull part? And you could always make the connection. Now you see it many, many times and you get the message. It's because, you know, your precepts weren't pure. You said something you shouldn't have done or done something you shouldn't have done. When I started seeing nimittas, you made a connection straight away. What you were seeing was your mind, your jitta. This was a reflection of your mind. Seeing it like in a body of water reflected back on you, like the moon reflected in the still waters of a pond. That's what you're seeing. And now you can actually see it very clearly. And if you'd broken a precept or done something selfish or cruel or unkind, even had a bad thought, then that would leave a stain on the jitta. And you could actually see it. It was like the nimitta, the vision in deep meditation. You couldn't deny it. Your nimitta was dull or dirty or grey. It would never inspire you. It would never be able to have the oomph to take you into the brilliant nimittas, which were the gateway to jhanas. It's a wonderful insight there, because that was the first time you could really see the direct relationship of sila and virtue to jhanas. Because without the sila, without the pure heart and the pure mind, you know, you don't get beautiful nimittas. And without beautiful nimittas, it's very difficult to get into jhanas. I almost said impossible, and you know the sort of the loopholes, looking for the most beautiful part stuff. But look, it is really helpful to have beautiful speech, beautiful actions, and importantly, beautiful thoughts. And I don't need to define what those are, because you feel them, you know them. You know a beautiful thought when you experience it. You know beautiful speech. You look at the suttas, if you like, with speech which goes to the heart, gentle, urbane, soothing to the ear. There's great sort of descriptions of what nice speech is. And that nice speech which you speak to others, especially when they're cruel to you, but you're kind back to them. So the gentleness of actions, you know, helping others, giving them a bit of assistance when they're running around, helping them out. And you know, I love doing that. You know, sometimes I was joking with Ajahn Kampong this morning. So there's, you know, sometimes I spend my time upatakin upatak. Upatakin is your attendant. I'm supposed to be the abbot, the senior monk, and sometimes you look after the attendant. I take some of the cups down for him. I did that the other day. And I love doing that. I get a lot of joy, sort of, you know, looking after my attendant. Even though, you know, this isn't supposed to be the other way around. I love doing that because you get this beautiful, pure, happy mind. So sometimes I'm a bit irreverent with the so-called roles of teacher, disciple. Sometimes I like to turn them around and just look after you if I possibly can. And who knows, Vimoka, you're looking after me. Maybe tomorrow I might wash your robes. Just for the hell of it, I don't know. But that gives you this incredibly joyful, pure mind. And if I did that, it'd be just because I need a jhana tomorrow afternoon or something, and I'd probably get one if I did things like that. You know, you just really get this beautiful mind state. I'm happy. So you sit down meditating, and straight away you're happy. And when you get that sort of past that sort of, you know, 5 cents stuff and settle the 5 senses down and you get nimittas coming up, nimitta will be beautiful and brilliant and so nice. So the sila does affect you. It affects the ability to get into deep meditation and to get into these jhanas and just go off and get enlightened as well. That's why please, please, please cultivate kind thoughts, kind actions and kind deeds. Look after one another. Look after your body. Be kind, be gentle, be caring. It's called the middle way. And it's one of the most attractive parts of Buddhism. To see like monks looking after one another. And sometimes forgetting about seniority and just looking after because, you know, you're my brother. And monks looking after nuns. Nuns are looking after monks. Anagarikas, monks. Monks, anagarikas, whoever. Novices. You know, because we're children of the Buddha. And that beautiful heart, that kindness, brings up a lot of joy. And metta does bring up joy. And you can't get into deep meditation with a hard mind, with no joy on it. And so often when people talk about their meditation with me in the interviews, sometimes, you know, you do get peace. The mind is pretty still, but it hasn't got the joy, the oomph which can generate the nimittas and take you into jhanas. The piti sukha part is absent. And that piti sukha part, you know, which is important in the path of meditation, look in the Anapanasati Sutta, at stage 5 and 6, breathing out, breathing in, you develop piti, breathing in and breathing out, you develop sukha. That's important in all parts of the meditation. 5th and 6th part of Anapanasati Sutta, and you also know in the gradual training, greater and greater joys and happiness, first of all, from keeping your precepts and from sense restraint. We know that from sayings of the Buddha like Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati, from happiness the mind gets into stillness. Happiness and joy is essential. Sooner or later the happiness and joy comes, because I know just being still for long periods of time, not doing anything, energy comes up and that energy creates enormous amounts of happiness and joy, but so does something else. And that is the beautiful virtuous practices which we do. So any time that you speak harshly, or you criticize someone, or you're negative in thoughts, you're actually losing that energy, you're losing the joy. You're giving up this important currency which will buy you a lot of progress in meditation. I look upon it in that way, in a worldly way. The good karma is a currency which you can spend in meditation to get deeper and deeper and deeper. You know what the good karma is? The joy, the happiness. So the good karma is the kindness, the goodness, the helping each other. Bad karma is the criticizing and negativity, putting yourself down, putting other people down. I also included putting yourself down there. That's bad karma too. We just do lots and lots of bad karma like that. There's no way you get the joy and happiness up. You're just too negative. And just you burn up whatever merits you've made that day. It's hard to make merits. So easy to burn them up and waste them with just one little thought of aggression or cruelty or negativity or fault finding. So instead we develop this beautiful positive mind, this kind, this gentle, beautiful mind. And all the people which inspire you, you can see their mind, just how much they give, how little they ask back, you know, how they don't criticize and just how they're just so positive and just build people up. And so grateful and say thank you and can I give you a hand and what can I do for you, and they really mean it. And that type of beautiful mind makes you a beautiful person, makes it very easy to live with you. But also you parlay it into your meditation practice. When you start meditating, such a person has an easy time getting jhanas. You don't get jhanas for your thoughts. I'm going to do this. This rains retreat, I'm going to get jhanas. No, nothing's going to stop me. That type of aggressive, hard mind is not what gets you anywhere. It just gets you stuffed up, too tight, never been able to let go, because it enhances your ego. Fault-finding builds up a stronger ego. It never makes it vanish. Anger, negativity is what builds. It's like the mortar which holds sort of the bricks of ego together. But kindness and compassion and forgiveness tears down the walls of ego. Because basically you're not controlling anymore, just letting things be. You're not disturbing the sound, you're not disturbing the situation, you're not disturbing the other people you live with, you're not disturbing life. You're just letting it be. Compassionate, kind, soft. But you go further, because I always remember that metta, it's not just I'm not harming other living beings. It's not just not stepping on the snails. It's just noticing the snail and removing it from the path and putting it in a nice, kind place where it can be happy. Kindness is not just refraining from kicking the cat. Kindness is actually looking after the cat, see if he wants some milk. So it's not kindness in the monastery. It's not just, you know, leaving people alone. It's just seeing how you can help each other, seeing how you can be kind and soothe each other. Being kind is not just saying I'm going to be in the present moment, because you find you can't stay in the present moment. You've got to be kind to the present moment and enjoy the present moment. Respect it, for goodness sake. This present moment, here it is. Stop finding fault with it. Let it be. Respect it. Find gratitude in it. Respecting it means, wow, what an amazing moment you are. I really care for you and I respect you. Present moment, what can I do for you? When you have an attitude like that, have this beautiful giving mind. It's not what you can give for me, present moment, but what I can give to you. It's not what I'm going to get out of this meditation, what I can give to it, how much I can let go, how much I can abandon. You know that sometimes you look at those the Christian monks, you know, the ones we know from New Norcia. Sometimes you're really impressed by their innate goodness and their kindness and how they look after one another. There's some 90-year-old monks there, and they really look after them, do everything for them. One of the things that was really moved me quite deeply was when I went to visit Sri Lanka for the first time. And I went up to the forest hermitage, I think it was, where Nyanaponika was staying. And his attendant was Bhikkhu Bodhi. And there was this great scholar, you know, with doctorate of philosophy before he became a monk. And he went up there and you saw him just looking after this elderly German scholarly monk, Venerable Nyanaponika, with such kindness and compassion. I'll never forget that. Just basically looking after his every need and being his like friend and companion for all those years until Nyanaponika died. And seeing such a beautiful way of caring made me actually quite surprised. I'm saying this of honesty, an anomaly, that someone like Bhikkhu Bodhi, looking after somebody like that, with that type of mind, how he could not get into sort of deep meditation afterwards. To me, that sort of care for someone else is just parlaying into deep meditation. It must happen. This, the thought comes into my mind of some of the caring things which I used to do. First year as a monk, I'd already ordained, and there were four monks, one of whom was Ajahn Kawesako, now Big Abba in the west of Thailand, the Japanese monk. He was ordaining with Ajahn Chah, and there was three other monks ordaining with him. No, two other monks, there was three of them in all. And in those days, if you were going to ordain as a monk, as a bhikkhu, you couldn't use your novice robes, but you had to make a full set of, you know, the lower robe, the antarvasaka, the uttarasanga, and the sanghati, a full set yourself. Sewing it, which took a couple of weeks, you know, you had to learn how to sew these things, especially the sanghati is a special way of doing it. And then you had to dye it, but first of all make the dye, and dye, which took about 2 or 3 days. That's no sleep. It was really tough and harsh. And I remember these three monks, Ajahn Kawesako was one of them, Jyotiko was another, who was a third? I think it was Aruno, if my memory serves me right. The two others were American monks. And it's hard work making dye in the northeast. You've got to get water from the well with buckets. I remember dropping that bucket into the well quite a few times. So you just got another monk, you hang onto the rope, and you went into that well and dived into it and got down the bottom to get the bucket out. So you literally went to the bottom of the well. And you really had to trust that monk on the other end of the rope, because if he just walked away, you'd be stuck in the well and die down there. It's a really scary thing to do. But did it quite a few times, but it's getting the water out and chopping up wood to make a fire and boiling it all up. And you had this jackfruit log which you had to chip away at. Those of you been to Thailand have seen how you do it to make the jackfruit dry. It took days to get the sap out of the wood, and then you had to boil the water down to concentrate it. And then it's only after a while, when you had enough dye, could you, dye all these robes, a lot of cloth. And even when you dyed them, you had to put them on the line, and you couldn't walk away for it to dry. You had to keep turning it every 1 or 2 minutes so the dye didn't streak. Oh, it's really hard work. And these three monks had been working about 36 hours. I think it was the second night, and they hadn't had any sleep. And after the evening chanting and meditation, just I went up to them. I don't know why other monks don't do this. I went up to them, look, guys, you know, you've been 36 hours. You must feel terrible. You go and take a break, and I'll look after the dye pot. But don't tell Ajahn Sumedho, you know, because they were supposed to be doing it themselves. So, you know, you go and have a rest. I'll stay up all night. And so I stayed up all night, and they were just so thankful they could get just, you know, 3 or 4 hours. And that sometimes that's all you need, just a bit of a break. So they didn't actually argue with me. They just ran away as quick as possible before I changed my mind. So there I was, looking after the dye pot, and 3 o'clock when the bell went, now they came up a few minutes later, and then I went off to the morning meeting. So I didn't sleep that night. But then, for those of you who've been to Thailand, the meditation in the morning, it's hot, mozzies are around, and you know, usually you have sloth and torpor. And I used to have great sloth and torpor. You know, bent over, half asleep. But I remember that morning I was just so alert. It's easy to watch the breath, a nice meditation. And I was only a member the first year as a monk, or maybe second year as a monk. I remember after alms round, I had just all this energy. And on the way back from the alms round, I took Ajahn Sumedho's bowl, because I was a young monk, I had to carry it for him. And I asked him, I said, look, this is really weird, Ajahn Sumedho. Sort of, you know, I was up all night, I confessed, you know, I helped these monks and sent them back. And of course, Ajahn Sumedho didn't mind. So it's a very nice, compassionate thing to do. You know, even though they were supposed to be doing their own robes, it's nice that you helped them. And I said, why have I got all this energy? And he looked at me and says, obvious. You've done a compassionate, kind act. You had a beautiful mind. Therefore, you got all this energy come up. You had a good meditation. Don't you understand the law of karma? And of course, the law of karma we usually apply to, oh, something, I'm sick, I must have done something wrong, I'm in pain, therefore I must have, you know, had a bad thought. We always look at karma on the negative side, but Ajahn Sumedho says, we did some good karma. This is instant karmic results. And it's so true, and I understood a lot from that experience. Just that kind mind which I had, even though I didn't sleep, and I should have been more worn out than usual, I had all this beautiful energy. And I parlayed that into a nice meditation that morning. I was just dancing along. So, you know, I thank those monks. No, thanks for letting me do that, guys. You know, you gave me the nice meditation. There wasn't, I never gave to you. You gave to me that night. And that's where I learn and how I'm imparting these experiences to you. That beautiful mind which we develop. That's how you get deep meditation. You have all these wonderful opportunities. And I'm actually very proud of you. Many of you got this, the idea in this monastery. You know, it's like Ajahn Wayama come to stay at the retreat center, and a couple of you were waiting there just to make sure she was all right and take things down. That's beautiful stuff. You know, you guys are going to get great meditation from that if you know how to make use of that good karma. You know, people sort of going there, spending their rains retreat instead of actually staying in the monastery, you go and look after like a four-year-old who's like dying of cancer. That's beautiful stuff. That's the sort of stuff, you know, you can't look for that. It just happens. And you just say, well, yeah, okay, I can do this. And you just give. You know, great good karma. And you get this beautiful mind. You've got to do it properly. If you do this, try to get good meditation, it doesn't work. It's a letting go. It's an abandonment. It's a selflessness. It's a purity of mind and heart, which even people who aren't Buddhists can recognize. Wow, that was really inspiring. Well done. Those sorts of states, they reflect just the attitude. And it's the same attitude as well as the good karma you produce outside, which you get and sit down, and wow, you're doing really well. Sit down, there you get the joy, the oomph of the meditation. So it's not just getting peaceful, but when you do get peaceful, wow, there's beautiful piti sukha and energy coming up, karmic. One of the things to do, though, is never be afraid of using your good karma. Because you know, all of you in this monastery, you know, even Nicholas just visiting every evening, you made huge amounts of good karma. You've got so much money in the bank. You know, you're a millionaire, Nicholas, billionaire. I see any of the monks here. And that's just Nicholas, let alone all the other people who are here. And even Glenda just coming to bring the nuns here. Wow, it's incredible, brilliant good karma. So when you go back, what have I done today? And you think of what you've done. I drove, gave up my sort of evening to drive the nuns, the sisters, to hear a Dhamma talk and drive them back again. To listen to Dhamma, to inspire, to move. And you think about that, wow, that's neat, that's cool. And you inspire yourself. When you're inspiring yourself, you get this incredible joy and happiness coming up, and wow, this is nice. Then you just watch your breath. And you find your breath is the easiest thing in the world to watch. No hindrances, no defilements. It's amazing how inspiration and piti sukha can be the power source, like a nuclear reactor which drives you deep into the heart of the mind. And you develop this. You develop this beautiful joy coming from compassion. It means when you develop this, when you come out of meditation afterwards, I mean, you're just so soft and kind to everybody else. Because you see, this is Dhamma. This is the way forward. Ajahn Chah used to say, you know, he used to say this because he trained us so well, not just to meditate, not just to keep the precept. Ajahn Chah stood out amongst all those these teachers in Thailand because he taught you how to be a leader and how to be an abbot. That's why he had so many disciples who started their own monastery, and the monasteries actually functioned well. Remember one thing he said, look, if you're going to be a leader of a monastery in the West later on, be kind, develop metta. Then you'll have lots of disciples and also lots of bliss. That was so, so true. So that kindness, that gentleness, the forgiveness. Oh, sometimes I forget it, human being. But you really try hard to make this a soft, beautiful monastery where people look after and care for each other and care for the people who feed them. and care for the Anagarikas who work so hard and drive. So if you're Anagarika, if you're someone who's driving you, please look after them and ask them, are you okay driving today? Do you want to stop? Do you want a cup of coffee? You know that purse in the car that's to be used. Even though sometimes I think, wow, where's all the money going? If it's making an Anagarika happy and you happy, go for it. That's what it's there for, a bit of compassion and kindness. So look after each other. You look after each other, you've got this beautiful mind that when you sit down and you walk kindly, so you don't sort of go walking so much that your feet start to bleed. You don't sort of sit too long that your body starts to get rashes or bruises. You don't sort of hurt your body. You're kind to it. And when you see this mind, or this little mind of mine, oh, sometimes I give you such a hard time, mind, forcing you to give talks all over the place, and trying to get you, mind, to squeeze out some new things to say or find some new jokes. It's just so hard, mind. I really give you a hard time. I really try hard and don't succeed, getting the new jokes. But nevertheless, you try hard to do this. And sometimes I really force my mind too much. And so when I meditate, okay, mind, I force you to give all these talks and trying to be smart and wise to help all these people who ask all these questions. But now, sit down, close my eyes. Mind, I'm going to let you go now. You've worked so much for me. You've worked so hard for me. I know that, you are my attendant. Now I'm going to attend on you. Mind, you want your robes washed. Mind, you want a cup of tea. Mind, you just want to think. Go, off you go. If that's what you want to do. You know what happens when you're kind to somebody? They like to hang around you. When you've got compassion, they just don't want to leave. That's what my mind is sometimes like. When I say such things, if you want to go and think and fantasize or go to sleep, that's fine with me. And I said, really? I said, yeah, it's okay. I said, and the mind says, no, I want to hang out with you. I want to stay with you. But I don't want to go off into fantasy. I don't want to leave. I want to stay in this moment, stay with your mindfulness, stay with your awareness. I just want to be here with you. That's how you overcome restlessness. I often contemplate, why am I restless? And trying to force the mind wanders off, bring it back. Mind wanders off again, bring it back. Mind wanders off again, bring it back. I've been there, done that for years. And it still wanders off. How many times do I have to bring you back, mind? Is there something wrong there somewhere? And obviously, you know the way. You experiment, you rebel, you try different things. Okay, mind, you want to go off you go. And they just want to go off anymore. Because of kindness, I realize, why did the mind wander off anyway? Because it wasn't having a good time with you. It didn't like you. That's why it wanted to go somewhere else. Why do people leave the monastery? Because they're not happy here. And I looked at that and thought, same with my mind. If my mind is happy staying with me in this moment, it won't want to go anywhere. So I really respect my mind. I'm kind to it. I'm gentle to it. And I give it some space. And I don't force it. Trouble is, because of ego, because of the sense of self, because of this is mine, this is me, this is the self, because you think you own your mind, you treat it like a slave. It's like the equivalent of domestic abuse, like men used to treat wives. This is sometimes how you treat your mind. Beating it up, ordering it as if it was a slave, abusing your mind by forcing it. And of course that's abuse, that's violence. And of course you never get anywhere that way. You just get stuffed up, you're making bad mental karma. So instead, when you look at your mind, no abusing your mind, but being kind, respecting, being a friend to your mind, not a master or a mistress. If you try and conquer your mind, you too will get conquered. If you try and fight the mind, you'll get bruised. because that's what happens in any fights. But if you're kind to the mind, gentle and peaceful, the mind will be kind, gentle and peaceful for you. It's a beautiful relationship with the mind. You just hang out together. Hanging out together is called samadhi, sustained attention. My old definition of samadhi, sustained attention. And when you sustain attention with the mind, you just stay there together because you're having fun together. And because you stay together, it makes it stillness. Stillness just comes. And you're not doing it, because doing it is force, it's control, it's aggression. It's trying to make it happen. Use this beautiful softness and kindness and gentleness and letting go, letting things be, making peace. All the right intentions of the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. All the things which you're supposed to do but you forget. You don't apply it to your own mind. When you're kind, you're gentle, you're peaceful, you respect your mind, the mind hangs out, stays. And you get these beautiful, beautiful experiences, just like you enjoy hanging out with your friends. Remember the times of the coffee club? You know, if you can remember that far back, 3 weeks ago. You know, you liked hanging out with your friends in the coffee club, didn't you? You had fun in there. And why did you like to hang out in the coffee club? Because you were enjoying it. Now imagine that was like your meditation was like another coffee club. You're hanging out there with the mind, having a great time. Well, you know, given a chance, you spend all afternoon there with your friend. And that's what the mind is like in meditation. The coffee club inside. We just hang out there and have a wonderful time. Piti Sukha starts just coming up. And you know, it's not an indulgence, it's not a fantasy, because if it really, fantasies are coming from negativity. Now, all lust usually comes as a response to not being happy. So this is your escapes from suffering. But when you're really happy in this moment, you are content. You don't need lust. You don't need anger. You don't need defilements anymore. This sort of emergency measure, which we've become so used to, it's our usual way of coping with the suffering of life. When that sort of that suffering isn't there, because you're just peaceful, you're happy, you're content, you're kind, that's when you stay still, you stay put. It's called stillness. With that sort of kindness and that gentleness and the joy, you just get into the deepest of meditation. You don't do it. You just get the causes in place, and this joy, this happiness is an important part of it. So you really enjoy the meditation, you enjoy your life, you enjoy being a monk, being a nun, being an anagarika, you enjoy the driving, you enjoy the sweeping, you enjoy the shitting if you have to go to the toilet. It just is good fun. Because you're kind. It's amazing just where you can get happiness and joy in monastic life. In places where other people would just not be able to do it. And when you understand that, you understand how to meditate. People say, it's just the most boring thing in the world just to sit there with your eyes closed and they think you've got to watch your navel. Incredibly stupid people. But you get in there and you have a fantastic time just being with your own mind, hanging out for hours. And it's just like sometimes these private jokes people have, and they're sitting there laughing together and say, what are you laughing at? So you just don't understand, do you? I'm hanging out with my mind, laughing my head off, and my mind is laughing back with me. And that's like jhana, only just a still laugh, just a ha which never ends. And this is the stillness and beauty of the mind, all coming because you're letting go, you're uniting with the mind, this one pointiness. You're not fighting anymore. You are the moment. You merge with it. You merge in the silence. You merge with the breath. You merge with the blissful breath. And these are the points I really love. The joyful, beautiful, delightful breath. The nimitta, where you start to understand the bliss better than sex. Oh, this is nice. Whoa, yeah. And just really get into it. Full on. And that's when you sort of get this incredible jhana stage, and come out afterwards and just so happy. afterwards. And that's when people just usually flows out into their emotions. They just cry for joy. And then you say, what happened there? Even if you don't think about it, just you know. You know that letting go of that world, the kindness, the gentleness, the acceptance, that things have disappeared, vanished. But you don't make them vanish. This is nature. So the more joy, the real joy you have, the more you disappear. And you just go out of samsara laughing your head off. Literally laughing your ego off, laughing yourself off, laughing your defilements off. They just disappear in the bliss and joy of freedom. That's how it happens. So, little by little, the whole path, the whole monastic life is almost a one thing. If you do it properly, just whatever you're doing in the monastery, you're having fun. Even if you're just talking about what colour you're going to have the vanity units in the retreat centre. Little things like that, which people think, oh, they're distractions. No, they're not. It's not that these things disturb you. It's just people disturb these things. Teaching Rajan Chai, the longer I'm a monk, just the more you just in awe of that monk's wisdom. How you could see something so deeply and put it in such a simple saying, which will never be past its use-by date. And you can keep using it again and again and again in all sorts of different circumstances. Ah, this is just like this master key which unlocks so many doors. It's not the noise disturbs you, you disturb the noise. It's not sort of the restless mind disturbs you, you disturb the restless mind. It's not the knee ache disturbs you, you disturb the knee ache. It's not that sort of bastard in the monastery disturbs you, you disturb them. It's amazing. And you get the hang of that. Wow, you're on the path. You're on the path of just having a wonderful time, blissing out. Who cares what other people say? Don't allow them to control my happiness. They can't. So just let the whole world go. And just bliss out, free yourself, become enlightened. Nibbanam paramang sukhang vadanti Buddha. Vadati Buddha. I've got to be very careful with my Pali now because I made a mistake of teaching other people Pali and now they know exactly what I'm saying and I can point out my mistakes. Nibbanam paramang sukhang. Nibbana is the ultimate bliss. So every getting closer to Nibbana must be getting closer to bliss. More and more happiness, more and more joy. So learn how to just bring joy into the mind by being kind, by being virtuous, by being pure-hearted. Cultivate that. It's as important as cultivating the hours on the seat. It's not what you do, but how you do it. That is the secret of meditation. That's the path out of the world. So that's the talk this evening.
Sukhati Pano Bhagavata.